So today's topic is the fifth faculty, wisdom. It's usually translated panya. And one of the points I'm trying to make for this retreat is that the translations into English are the choice of the translator and of the practitioner. You can choose to make it different within a range, of course. But so for panya, I think I like the word wisdom, so it's okay with me. But there's one translator who translates as discernment, which I like also. And the advantage over discernment over wisdom, some people can think if you just read enough books, you'll acquire lots of wisdom, lots of knowledge, or you have something that you suddenly see or experience and practice, and then you just kind of tuck it into your back pocket, you know, and carry it with you. Okay, pull it out. Oh, yeah, that applies. As if it's like knowledge that you carry with you. And there's a story that I don't know where it's from, but it's supposed to be from the ancient world, but I'm not sure. That Mara is out walking with his disciple. And they come across a monk who's doing walking meditation. And suddenly the monk goes, "Yay! Now I see the truth. This is the truth." And the disciple to Mara says, "Aren't you worried?" Because the whole Mara's whole job description is to prevent people from becoming awakened, seeing the truth and becoming awakened. So the disciple says, "Aren't you worried?" No, not at all. Soon enough, he'll make it into a belief. So wisdom, so the word discernment, you don't have, might not have those associations that we don't, but so I think it's so easier, wisdom to be kind of like a knowledge, something you carry with you and apply. Discernment is something you do in the moment. You're discerning. And you don't discern today and then it's a done deal. Then it's just memory or then it's a belief or something else. But there's this faculty, this ability we have to go into any situation and be discerning. And we do it all the time, sometimes in second nature. We go into some place and we discern what's happening and we change our behavior, our speech, and all kinds of things depending on the circumstances we walk into. And so to be discerning and practice means to, moment by moment, we're discovering, we're seeing clearly what's there, clearly how we're operating, what's going on for us. And that's where the wisdom comes from. So in that regard, I prefer to translate panya as insight. And insight also implies this is something you do in the moment, you're seeing clearly. It's not something you reasoned out or been told. It's something you actually see. We have a capacity to see very deeply or very clearly. And it's that capacity we're developing, clear seeing. So these five faculties, and if you allow me to kind of translate them, or maybe render them is a better word, in ways that I like, inspire me, is love, vitality, complete presence, wholeness and insight. And you don't have to accept those at all, but you get a sense of maybe some kind of, maybe expands out the range for you, what these faculties might be, so that there's more space for you to kind of relax into them or open into them, make room for something wonderful inside. They're faculties, they're abilities that live within us, maybe sometimes as seeds that are waiting to sprout. But I propose that they're actually in all of us. They're all, you know, always available. The ordinary things we do in everyday life, those five faculties are operating without you ever having thought about it. If you drive a car, you probably have some confidence and faith and trust that you can drive the car. Otherwise you wouldn't do it, probably. I hope you wouldn't. That you have some, hopefully you put some good effort and energy and care in driving the car. You know, don't just put it in autopilot and go to sleep. And I hope you're mindful. I hope you stay aware. And then you do need some degree of concentration to drive a car. You have to be in the present moment. You have to pay attention. If you concentrate on getting just the right radio station, you're in trouble. And then you should need to be discerning. You need to have insight. You need to see clearly what's happening in the traffic and the conditions, and so you know how to navigate. The five faculties are right there. So to move into this topic of panya, is it ringing, the speaker system? It is, isn't it? I think I'll turn it down and I'll try to speak up. It's partly my fault for having such a low voice, quiet voice. So can you hear me okay? And if I talk too softly, then you can raise your hand or something and I'll try to speak up. The Buddha could speak to a assembly of 500 people without the speaker. There's a Vipassana teacher, wonderful Vipassana teacher in the United States named Shinzen Young. Very creative, in many ways, creative with the practice, creative with the teachings, in very brilliant ways. And he developed a way, a protocol, for teaching mindfulness to young teenagers. And the way it was told to me was seemed to be boys, but I don't know, but maybe it was a boys' club, or I don't know what it was, but anyway, that's the way it was told to me. And this was the protocol. These teenagers were invited to bring some of the music they like listening to the sessions. And the mindfulness teacher would not teach mindfulness. Rather, would ask them questions before and after listening to the music. And the nature of the questions were such that it trained these kids or pointed these kids, these teenagers, into paying attention in a particular way, which was being mindful. So he took what they were interested in and kind of in their own interest and what they like, kind of evoked a heightened sense of attention, care, discernment to their experience. But there was a really important, and then they would ask questions of these kids. But it was the most important part of this process was whatever the teenagers answered, whatever they answered the questions, they were never wrong. The facilitator would never contradict or say, oh, that's not quite right, or it was always accepting, always working with their answers as if they were completely acceptable, appropriate, or something. And because they said that at that age, they're hypersensitive to the slightest thing that can look like a judgment or that you're wrong or something. And so that combination of the questions they were asked and this attitude of nothing's wrong here. There's no judgment coming from the teacher, no expectation, no demand. These highly sensitive, discerning kids who will pick up so much. The most nervous times, I think, in my career as a mindfulness teacher was when I used to teach a children's program. I mean, the discernment they have and the willingness to show you right away is really high. I once told a bunch of ninth graders, so these are, I guess, teenagers now. I was teaching them a day long, or maybe it was a half a day, of meditation and Buddhism, and I told them that I hadn't watched television since 1972, and I could see that my credibility in the room dropped. And I had to work to get my credibility up again. So this way of working with these teens, I thought was really brilliant. But this attitude of acceptance, perhaps, or non-judgment, non-criticism, allowing them to be how they are, I would suggest that that required a lot from the facilitator. Certainly faith and trust that was important. Effort, energy, to really be attuned to that and pay attention to that and stay close to that. It takes a fair amount of mindfulness because you have to tune into the kids, tune into yourself, tune into what you're about to say, evaluate it. Does it need some concentration? I know I would be concentrated if I was trying to teach a bunch of teenage boys. I would like, oh, maybe I'd be a little tense too. You know, oh, yeah. Got to really pay attention carefully here. And then discernment. And one of the discernments is about oneself. What's appropriate? What's the way to be here? What's my attitude? What's going to avoid causing harm here? What's useful? So part of discernment in this practice is to do that for yourself. To be discerning about how are you relating to yourself? How are you relating to your experience? How are you meeting it? How are you with it? Are you seeing yourself like that was a mistake, you did it wrong, it should have been differently? If you are, you might want to awaken the inner teenager and show the facilitator what you think. So that poor facilitator in there can be more attuned and attentive and realize, oh, that didn't work, that wasn't quite it. Can you be discerning enough so that you avoid being critical? Avoid to yourself. Avoid being hostile to your experience. Avoid having expectations and agendas. Avoid deciding anything about yourself and your experience is wrong. One of the things that I did when I discovered my early years of meditation, and it was so subtle that's one of the reasons you get to meditate a long time, like on a retreat, because then maybe you have a chance to get quiet enough to see how repetitive our attitudes are that are quieter and kind of usually covered over. One of the ones that I discovered was, if it's happening to me, it's not real. It's not what's really supposed to be happening. So if I had any kind of meditation experience, it wasn't the real experience. It wasn't quite what it was. If I got calm, it's not the real calm. If I, you know, got relaxed, it's not the relaxation we're supposed to have. There was nothing, everything. There was the general all-around policy. In some ways, life was easier that way, just to have one policy and don't have to make any decisions. But, you know, it was a drag on my meditation. It was always there, and always feeling, oh, that's not it, that's not it, that's not it. So these attitudes we have that we carry with us that are not helpful. So discerning that and discovering that, and then can we find a way that this, I don't know, maybe you'll forgive me, they say the inner teenager can feel like they have a chance to relax and you can be yourself and find your way. Like these teenagers in the protocol were allowed to be who they are, and then these questions were asked that help them find their way and discover for themselves something. In the teen protocol, there was never any teaching about you should do this, this is what you should do with your life, you're supposed to now, I taught you mindfulness, now do this. If it had value, the teenagers would discover that for themselves and decide for themselves, independent of the facilitator, oh, this was interesting, this was useful, this is something to do more of. So to be discerning, how are you? And so the teaching I gave at the beginning about these 17 imperfections that defile the mind. One of the things that's interesting about these 17, they are all ways of relating to something. They're relating in ways that soil the mind, that spoil the mind. I was not happy with the translation, imperfections that defile the mind, so I went and looked in the original Pali text. It turns out the word imperfections is not in the text at all. That's an addition of the translator. But the word that defiles, which is a powerful word in English, in Pali, the word is spoils or soils. So it's these are the things that spoil the mind, soil the mind. The advantage of that translation is that if you spoil the mind, or maybe not spoil, but if you soil the mind, you can clean it. If you're imperfect, well, tough. If you have defilements, then, you know, that's like almost like, well, people will interpret it as original defilement. This is my original sin. And that's the way it is. And that's another one of these very subtle, very undercurrents of belief that we can operate under. That somehow we're fundamentally wrong. Our original wrongness. Another one that I had was guilt. Original guilt. It was remarkable. I could be guilty without having done anything. Guilty before I did anything. Just a policy. So that I also discovered when doing this practice and kind of had to work through. So these 17 are all ways of relating to something, to think something in the world, to people, to ourselves, to what's happening within us. So I'll read them to you. What are the things that spoil the mind? So listen for how there's something about relationships or relating to something. Covetousness, coarse greed, ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, and carelessness. These are what soil the mind, spoil the mind. So they're all a way of relating to something that's going on. So is it possible to experience ourselves free of all those relationships? And it is. And so then the text, as I talked about the other day, talks about abandoning all those, letting all those come to quiet down, become still, not be there. And then the mind becomes, by inference, becomes clean of those, that which is soiling it. The reason that Buddha apparently gave this teaching is because the person he was had been talking to, there was someone who, a non-Buddhist, who would go into so they had this belief that some rivers in India, you can go into the river and it'll cleanse you of all your impurities. And and so this man, he asks the Buddha, does Master Gotama go to the river to bathe? Implying go to the river to do the sacred bathing that purifies the impurities. And the Buddha says, why go into the river? What can the river do? And the man says, Master Gotama, the river is held by many to give liberation. It is held by many to give merit, and many wash away their evil actions in the river. And the Buddha responds, a fool may forever bathe in this river, but will not purify their dark deeds. The river cannot purify an evildoer, a person who has done cruel and brutal deeds. One pure in heart is evermore living the holy day, the holiday. One pure in heart brings one's virtue to perfection. It is here that you must bathe. So you bathe in the purity of your actions, the non-harming of your actions. That's where you bathe, pure of heart. It is here that you should bathe. And this next line is my favorite line in this text. It is here that you should bathe to make yourself a refuge for all beings. This I looked up before, that Pali is not refuge, it's safe. To make yourself safe for all beings. What a great thing to do. We're back in the world of relationships. Now we're talking about a relationship that you're safe for people. Those teenage mindfulness teachers were making the temple safe for those teenage boys. Are you safe for yourself? And if you speak no falsehoods, nor work harm for living beings, nor take what is offered not, with faith and free from avarice, what need do you have to go into the river? So it's in that context when the Buddha talks about these things that soil the mind. And to live a life that is ethical, that has some degree of care and not non-harming, is that cleanses us. And then doing a practice where we see and recognize, how am I relating here? Am I relating to anything in a way that brings stress, brings suffering, or that causes harm? This is a powerful act of discernment. One of my absolute favorite, maybe top five, quotes from the Buddha is his definition of what a wise person is. A wise person is someone who considers the welfare of themselves, the welfare of others, the welfare of self and others, and the welfare of the whole world. Wow. Isn't that? I think that's fantastic. That's what a wise person is. So to be discerning, where's the harm? Where's the benefit? Where's the safety? How to be here in this world? How do I rectify? How do I look at and recognize the ways I relate? In some ways, what the heart of Dharma practice is not what's happening to you, but how you relate to what's happening. The how is important. And as Andrea so well has talked about, the how we're aware, to be aware in a very simple, open, receptive way. It's the awareness is also a kind of a relationship we have. A relationship of knowing, a relationship of being aware of something. We're always aware of something, and pretty much always. But are we? What's the relationship we have with it? Is the relationship one that brings suffering and harm? We have the ability to be present without any inclination to cause any harm. We have the ability to be present and aware without covetousness, greed, ill will, anger, envy, resentment, and all these things. We have that capacity. It is possible. To taste that, to know that enough, it doesn't have to be dramatic, but to have a sense of that, that's what we can trust. And if sadha, faith, is loyalty, fidelity to that possibility, fidelity to that experience of living a life that doesn't cause any harm to self or others, to have that absence. But it's more than just an ethical thing, not causing harm. When we can free ourselves of those forces in the mind, then we switch over to the second paradigm, the second operating system that we have. These things that soil the mind are the operating system of greed, hate, and delusion, the opposite system of constructing and making and proving a self. When all those relax, and we're not in relationship between the constructed self and the world, but rather allowing our biology to operate, the biological or physiological source of our goodness, I talked about this before. So one considers like this. These things that soil the mind have in part, been given up and relinquished in me. One then gains inspiration in this purpose. Gains inspiration in the Dhamma. Gains gladness, delight, connected with the Dhamma. When one is glad, and this is, joy is born in one. And I read this because of the word born. This is the gestational, this is the incubation. This is this inner other operating system in us that can operate. To be discerning and see, and what operating system is operating in us? Are we operating under this greed, hate, and delusion? Are we operating under me, myself, and mine? It's all about me. Are we operating under the conceit that I'm a terrible person? Are we caught up in all the different strange ways, difficult ways, and that our society and ourselves have kind of got caught up in this whole self thing? That can be seen and recognized and known. Or can I somehow relax, be aware, be receptive to something else operating here, which is not this self-construct? Something else, make room for something to be born. One of the fascinating questions to ask yourself when you're having some difficulty, especially, you know, inner difficulty, psychological, emotional difficulty, is kind of settle back a little bit. Like, imagine you're in an easy chair. It's like settle back, or in a nice park bench on a nice day, and you finally get a chance to sit down and just kind of be a little bit not caught in the difficulty. And then ask yourself the question, what wants to be born here? What wants to come out of this, the phoenix arising from the ashes? What wants to be born? Maybe everything that we have, all our challenges, are kind of an egg. That if you care for it right, something in there wants to hatch. Something wonderful. I kind of believe that. So anyway, so the other operating system was delight, gladness is born. When one is glad, joy is born. And in one who has joy, the body becomes tranquil. When one's body is tranquil, one feels pleasure, happiness. When one feels happiness, the mind becomes concentrated. This is all kind of, it's described in a way that just flows one from the other. Maybe it sounds a little like a fairy tale for some of us. Like, you've got to be kidding. You're supposed to be, you know, like, you know, I'm a doer, you know, and I know how to do things. You know the story? Probably you've heard it many times. The person who goes to the monastery says, if I come here and become a monk and practice, you know, I'm capable and I'm smart and succeed in everything I do. And how long will it take to become enlightened? And the abbot says, oh, about 10 years. So, 10 years? But you don't understand. I can really apply myself. I have all this intelligence, all this capacity. I can really give it. I can do the perfection of effort. How long will it take then? Oh, the abbot says, in that case, it'll take 20. So this, you know, the willfulness. And so this discernment. So as we start noticing how we're relating, what we're trusting, are we trusting the self-construct? Are we trusting needing to prove ourselves, needing to defend ourselves? Are we trusting our anger? Are we trusting our fear? Are we trusting our greed? Or are we trusting non-greed, non-hatred? Are we trusting the letting go of this, these painful, suffering-producing ways of relating to everything? As we become discerning and see this, how it operates for us, and we begin to relax, and we don't have to let go of this entirely. And here it says, just in part, even, makes a difference. Then we start to have more clarity. When the windshield is cleaned, we see out of the windshield clearly. And that is one of the aims of doing this practice, is to start seeing more and more clear without the overlay of our projections, the overlay of our expectations, the overlay of our agendas, the overlay of our judgments and our bias, our prejudices, the overlay of needing to prove ourselves, the overlay of our competitions, the overlay of our all kinds of things. These overlays, these filters by which we see things, they begin to quiet and quiet and quiet. At some point, it's quiet enough that we see that, and again, the seeing, this insight, we see that the way that I'm thinking is a projection. The way that I'm thinking is a filter. The way that I'm thinking is extra. One of the wonderful parts of this practice, I think, especially on a retreat practice, is the really important discernment that really has a great applications, is slowly, maybe on day six, maybe, some point, you know, your thinking mind finally gets quiet. The first day, couple of days, probably a lot of thinking, and slowly gets quieter. At some point, it's quiet enough, and you're settled enough and calm enough that, you know, some resentment you have towards someone who did you something wrong 30 years ago, that thought about that person arises. I mean, what a great opportunity. You're on retreat, you're not distracted. I mean, you can go to town now and really have it out with that person in your mind. I mean, this is like a golden opportunity, right? Or you're calm enough, quiet enough, you see the thought arise, and you say, no, thank you. I'm in a good space right now. This is good to be finally calm and settled and peaceful and not agitated and not causing harm with all my machinations. This is a good place. If I pick this up, I'll harm myself. If I pick this up, I'll agitate myself. There's a loss. I'll get soiled. And the amazingly good place is you can see that and to have the ability to say, no, thank you. Wow. Not that. Not that. Not that. It's not an easy thing to do in ordinary states of mind or many times, but the time will come, and that can be elicit a lot of faith and confidence. Wow. There are better alternatives, a better way of being than the way I've always been caught up in these everything with my mind and my thoughts and living in my thoughts and churning and doing, making. So there starts to be a discernment of what to pick up and what to leave alone. I don't have to pick things up so much. I can leave things alone. I can leave alone my thoughts and my projections. As that brings more clarity, and with clarity, we start seeing that in the present moment, when we're really in the present, because we're not thinking about the past and future, present moment experience, without the overlay of ideas, without the overlay even of what we think it is a river of change. Present moment, we're in the river of time. Everything is changing and moving and shifting and coming and going. And part of the function of this clarity of practice is to find ourselves in that river of change. Not the river in India that this guy said, you know, that's going to clean you, but the river of the changing nature of experience in the present moment. When we can really stay intimate and close to the sensations that are coming and going, to the sensory quality of life, vitality, here and now, maybe we can't stop thinking, but we start seeing even the thoughts are just streams of change that are coming. You'll recognize a new thought, maybe your favorite thought, your favorite way of being depressed. And you see that thought arise, and you say, oh, it wasn't there before, and now it's there. See it arise, see it go. See it arise, see it go. To have that ability to settle back. And this is why this idea of relaxing, being receptive, being aware, being allowing, really begins to come alive for practice. When in that space that's created, we're just there to let everything flow by. And we start seeing that as we live in the river of the present moment, where everything is shifting and changing, it doesn't make any sense to cling to any of it. It turns out that when you're really quiet, really still in this flow of change, not relating to it through any defilements, not relating it to it in any way except for what is born from within, arises from deep inside, that you actually can't cling to anything. It doesn't work. You'll try. Have you ever tried grabbing a whole bunch of air so you can take it home with you? Come on. It's kind of like that when you're, it's kind of a little bit, believe it or not, a little bit of an illusion that we successfully cling to anything. Because we're clinging to not things, we're clinging to ideas. And the ideas have no more substantiality than the air we're in. So you try, so this grabbing, and that's a fascinating place to be. It's even when you're really in this changing flow of the present moment, by the time your hand gets to the object, it's already gone. It's kind of like the clown at the circus that bends over to pick up the ball, but then one of his feet kicks it further. And then he goes, walks up to the ball and bends down to pick it, and he kicks it again. He never gets it. So part of the discernment is to start seeing how quickly things which are not ideas, Platonic ideas, how quickly things are shifting and changing and moving, and how supportive it is to see that, to begin allowing this deeper operating system within us to begin to bubble up and fill out. It can give birth to a lot of feeling of wholeness and goodness, of warmth and joy. And then this discernment of that, the insight into change is the primary source for wisdom in our tradition. The real essential liberating insight, liberating wisdom, comes from really being attuned to how much things are changing all the time. And then the discernment is to see sometimes that we're close to that, and then a thought arises, and then we're living in a kind of permanence. The oatmeal in the morning is really good. I mean, it's the best oatmeal. And so you're having the oatmeal, and it's kind of impermanent. You know, it goes into the mouth, you swallow it, you get another spoonful, it comes and goes. But your mind has drifted off into how you're going to make oatmeal at home, and how perfect it's going to be, and the recipe, and you're living in an ideal world of thoughts that are all about the perfect. And then you remember the oatmeal at the IRC. That was the perfect oatmeal. And then I like this, that you'll permanently believe that that the oatmeal at the IRC is the perfect oatmeal in the world. Thank you. But it's just an idea. And that idea will get old quickly. I mean, I'd like you to kind of leave here carrying that with you and, and go tell your friends and make sure that they tell their friends about the oatmeal and write it down in your journal so you won't forget. I mean, just that should be like a permanent thought. But isn't that ridiculous? Just enjoy the oatmeal. I've had something really nice sometimes, like oatmeal, and then started thinking about something about it, and then I don't enjoy the oatmeal that I'm eating because I'm so absorbed in my thoughts. And then we start seeing that some of the thoughts, some of the attitudes, some of the approaches, some of the relationships we're forming are around this whole concept that there's a self, there's a me here, there's a concentration of energy, a concentration of tension, tightness, pressure. There's kind of a straining in the eyes, the shoulders, and the brain around this constellation of this is who I am. Sometimes it's possible to feel it as pressure inside. And so there's discernment around, I don't need that. You don't have to decide there's no self. But you can see, that's just one more overlay. That's just one more complication. It was so nice to be peaceful. And then the self arrived. Let the self be the self. You don't have to answer the philosophical question if there is or is not a self. If it's not there, enjoy it. And if it's not there, and you see it appear, and it's a source of stress, maybe you can let go of it. You don't need it. So the discernment around self and not having to play the self game. The discernment that clinging to self, clinging to anything, is unsatisfactory. It just causes more suffering. These are some of the core insights, discernments, not to believe, but to see in the moment how they operate. And the ideal way of seeing it is seeing it so every moment of discernment is reminding you, helping you to stay relaxed, stay receptive, stay aware, so that it is not just so that part of the rectifying or cleaning up your relationship to everything is how awareness relates, so that how you're aware has not been taken hostage by our desires, taken hostage by our ideas of self. We're just aware. We're aware with space, with spaciousness. We're aware where we give room for everything in such a way that mindfulness, awareness, will not help you get liberated. Maybe you will never be liberated. For some of you, that maybe that was good news. Some of you is like, what am I doing here then? What will happen is that you will liberate everything from you. You're freeing everything from yourself. You're giving everything permission, the right to exist, independent of you getting tied up in it, or wanting it, or needing it, or judging it. We're giving freedom to our friends, freedom to our family, freedom to our neighbors, freedom to our pets, freedom to the oatmeal. Freedom to whatever we're doing, whatever it is, we're freeing it from all the machinations, all the complexities of our projections, our neediness, our demands, our ill will, all the complicated ways of relating that maybe are represented by these 17 things that soil the mind. And I say this, and I'll end with this statement, that to free yourself from the idea that you're going to become free might make it a lot easier to become free. You're just giving freedom to everything else. And in doing so, may you become a person who is safe for all beings. We live in a world that has a tremendous need for more safety. May this practice that we're doing transform us into being safe for all beings. Thank you.